Welcome, everybody, to a very special edition of KickServeRadio.com Tennis on Air with Andy Zoden. And today, my very special red carpet guest is the great Richie Renneberg. One of the things I really enjoy about doing what I do on air is that I get to go back and reminisce with some guys that I grew up with. In particular, Richie Renneberg, growing up in Houston, Texas, was one of the most successful and highly revered junior players before deciding to go play collegiately at SMU and then become one of the top American players on the tour. Richie, so great getting caught up after all these years. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, Andy.
And I remember watching you play as just an 8-year-old peanut, and everybody had a lot of respect for you in those days. And you never disappointed those of us that expected you to go on to the kind of stardom that you enjoyed in college and in the pros. I want to start with one memorable match that you had, and I know it's got to some extent sort of stand out above the rest. When we think of a lot of the great matches of all time that were played at Wimbledon, Borg-McEnroe 1980 comes to mind, Nadal-Federer 08 comes to mind. You and Jim Grab in 1992 lost to John McEnroe and Michael Stich, two former Wimbledon singles champions, 19-17 in the fifth. The match lasted a couple of days. It gets suspended at 13-all due to darkness. You had a couple of match points. It had to have been somewhat heartbreaking. Take us back to that day and one of the most historic matches of all time.
Yeah, well thanks. Yeah, no, that was, I guess, to the extent you can have a good loss, at least in my look, that was a good loss. I mean, I grew up looking up to John, and I was friends with Patrick. Patrick and I played against each other, and we were friends since we were 11. And so I always really admired and liked John. And not that I wanted him to win that match, but ended up being his last Wimbledon. And you know, it was a nice way for him to go out, given the career he had. But yeah, we had a long match. It was a Wimbledon where there was a lot of rain. So we got to the final. We were playing it on the old court once. You know, I think if I recall correctly, Jim and I won the first set. We lost the second in the tiebreaker, won the third, lost the fourth set, I believe, in a tiebreaker. Got to 13-all in the fifth, and it was dark. We played well beyond what we normally, I'm sure, would have played. I think in other years when they had carried single finals over to Monday, the crowds were sort of, I think in most cases, so I heard, if and so. On this day, it ended up after, like I said, 2 weeks of rain, being a beautiful sunny day on Monday, we're driving to the court, and these lines, you know, a mile long, like they are at the first day of the tournament. And if I recall correctly, they let everyone in for free. So you had, there was a great atmosphere, great environment. I think when it was all said and done, I think even, you know, John was very happy that we all came back the next day. So it was a great memory, even though it was the one in the lost column.
Well, I tell you what, one that went in the win column, and correct me if I'm wrong, Richie, was it later that year that you and Jim would team up and win your first major, which would be the U.S. Open? Do I have that chronologically correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we finaled at Wimbledon, and then played John and Michael Stich in the semis of the Open, beat them, and then won in the final.
And you went on to enjoy a nice career playing Davis Cup for the United States as well, Richie, and now it looks like U.S. tennis is starting to have somewhat of a resurgence. The Davis Cup team earlier this year got a good win down in Australia. In fact, the Fed Cup team got a good win in Australia over this very weekend. Talk about some of your favorite memories representing the United States. I know that James Blake said that he never felt more proud to be on a tennis court than when he had USA written across his chest. Did you feel like that as well?
I did. It came with a lot of pressure. I mean, back when I was playing, my career high in singles was number 20 in the world. I don't think I was ever higher than 6 or 7 in the U.S. So I'd say there was no better feeling than if you played a Davis Cup match and won the Davis Cup match. That was about as good as it got for me.
Obviously, a lot of people look at the sport as having become far more global, and we're seeing things happen in Europe and in South America that have really evened the scales. There used to be so much dominance, and I think American tennis fans have become spoiled. Certainly, the game has changed. Back in your day, a guy could win by just wearing a guy down, similar to what we saw with Rafael Nadal today, wearing Gael Monfils down to win his 9th title at Monte Carlo. We don't see as much of that now. It's big serve, big forehand tennis. And do you think that overall game style has been to the detriment of American tennis and they need to get back to being a little bit more adept from all areas of the court?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I really believe if someone lacks a weapon, I don't think that necessarily precludes them from having a successful career. You know, I remember Michael Chang, everyone thought you know, he can't hit the ball hard enough. He's not, his serve isn't good enough. And, you know, I'd say he had a pretty good career. So, but I do think the game has changed a little bit. Technology, it's like all sports. I think that, you know, I don't think it's completely different than when I played, but I think it's, guys do hit the ball very, very hard. And so, I mean, in terms of U.S. tennis, though, I mean, I think a lot of times it also just kind of, you get a great player who kind of, right now, if we had one of these young players become, you know, do something great, say at the Open or at Wimbledon, and then all the other kids want to try to, you know, match that or like see that it's possible. And there are a lot of factors that go into why kids from different countries come out. But they, you know, another interesting case study is Sweden. You know, they were pretty dominant when I started on the tour, and they were for some time after that. They've really fallen off. So it's hard to know what drives it, but it does seem that we've got a good group of young Americans that, you know, hopefully will, like I said, kind of get things back to where they were previously.
And a couple of guys, Richie, that I want to ask you about that are peers of yours that were out on the tour in your era that are sort of in important positions with American tennis are Martin Blackman, who is the head of USTA player development, and of course Jim Courier, who's captain of the Davis Cup team. How do you feel about American tennis being in the hands of those two, and what do you think that they offer American tennis going forward?
Well, I mean, I also, just going back a step, I think the world of Patrick McEnroe. Like I said earlier, I've known Patrick since we were 10 or 11, and I would bet on him to, you know, to get anything right, whether it's in tennis or anything else. And I know that he had a lot of good coaches working alongside him. But in terms of Courier, and I used to train a lot with Jim, he is a terrific guy. He is smart and an incredibly hard worker, and someone that I think every player, you know, every young player coming up would look up to. Martin Blackman, I saw firsthand. When I quit tennis, I went to work for a guy named Ken Brody, who built the Tennis Center College Park that has become, I think, a very successful junior tennis program. And it was really, when Martin came in, he really did a fantastic job of organizing the place. He's, you know, a terrific human being and somebody who I think, you know, with those two guys spending time on it, I think that's a good team to have in place. I also think that, you know, some of the success now, you know, Patrick was, it wasn't that long ago, Patrick was doing it. And so, you know, I sort of heard through the grapevine at the end, Patrick, you know, some criticism, but I think Patrick is a great guy. And I think, you know, he would deserve some credit for a lot of credit for what's going on now.
I agree with you about Patrick, Richie. I was fortunate enough to be able to spend some time with him on air, and he could not have been more of a gentleman. It just seems like if he could be maybe accused of anything, it's just having so darn much on his plate with everything that he's doing in television. I think there's so much dedication that goes to doing what now Martin Blackman is doing that I think it was just maybe, I think Patrick probably realizing that with what needs to go into this, I may not be your guy with everything I'm trying to balance. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, no, I would guess that's right. Like, you know, Patrick, being the Davis Cup captain for a while, he's a terrific commentator, you know, and I think it also, you know, the USTA is a, you know, you only can kind of typically do things for so long there. And he had a very long run as head of player development. And, you know, I think it's, it sounded like he was ready to kind of do something else, ready to kind of turn over the reins. And I would bet he did a good job, and I think very highly of him.
Well, Richie, I think very highly of you, as do all of us that grew up with you and all American tennis fans. And you made reference to what you did after your 13-year career, and you went into high finance. You're living out in D.C. now. Last I read, you were one of the principals and head of investor relations at Taconic Capital. And it doesn't surprise me or anybody that got to know you that you would have a high position with investor relations. Personality-wise, I could see that being a perfect fit for you. How's that all going?
You know, it's been really fun. I mentioned that I met a guy named Ken Brody when I was retiring, and he was, we had some mutual friends in DC, and he was, they had said, you know, I should talk to Ken for career advice, because I was kind of looking to do something outside of tennis when I first, retired. And I met Ken, and, he was interested in talking to me about the tennis center that at that time it was just being built. And he called me a couple months after we met and said, you know, why don't you come to work for us? And, you know, we're not sure if it would become a job or not, but, you know, you might learn something, and if a year later either it doesn't appear there's that much for you to do, then you can go back to school like you're planning to do. And so I had the great fortune of meeting Ken, and then his partner, a guy named Frank Rosens. I've been working for them for 16 years, and I enjoy it. You know, it was fun to do something a bit different, and I do still like to kind of, I'm somewhat involved with the tennis center at College Park. So I still, you know, obviously spent most of my life playing tennis, and I love it. And so I like to get involved when I can.
Well, I'll tell you what, Richie, I've been doing this radio thing for just under a decade, and you have been very high on my hit list for a long time. When in the world am I going to reconnect with Richie Renneberg after all these years? I think that as a player, people remember you as being one of the top college players in the country, but, you know, prior to that, being one of the top juniors coming out of Texas, and a very respectable, admirable pro career representing the United States. But what people don't often realizes is what a great sportsman you were always regarded as, and how popular a player you were on the tour. And I think we see a lot more of that now on the tour, since Federer sort of stepped into prominence, and I think Nadal and Djokovic have followed suit. And I think we're seeing a much more dignified level of champion. And I think you definitely set the bar very high when it comes to all that. To be able to connect with you after all these years is a real treat. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's, that was one of the things. I don't know why. I mean, I believe I had my moment, I think it was one of the things that helped me try not to get too high and try not to get too low. And I would agree with you. You know, I think that, I felt very lucky to play during a time when, you know, I first started on the tour in 87, Yvonne Lendl was in his prime, got a chance to play John McEnroe a few times. And then, of course, along came, you know, Becker and Edberg and Sampras and Agassi and Courier and Michael Turing and Pat Rafter, and so, you know, it was a great time for me. I played a lot of great players, a lot of great people, and I often get asked the question, are people, the guys on the tour really get along? And what, from what I saw, they do. You know, it's a good group of guys, and I felt very lucky to do that for 13 years.
Well, we felt very lucky to be able to have you to look up to, Richie. Even the older guys in Texas looked up to you. But I like you say, I have fond memories watching you play and representing Texas so beautifully. Thanks again for joining us on KickServeRadio.com. And now that we've connected like this, hopefully this can be something that we do from time to time.
Sounds good, Andy. Anytime. Thanks a lot for having me on.